Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter. Today we're going to talk with someone in the film industry, very familiar to KCBX listeners, but we're going to talk about a side of their role in the industry he's never talked about on KCBX.
Why some films hit from the get-go and how others don't is beyond me. Like, for instance, Juno, Little Miss Sunshine, Black Swan, Day One packed.
We're going to look forward to next month, National Poetry Month, with the Slow Public Library.
Lewis Carroll did with Jabberwocky what J.R.R. Tolkien did with three large books.
And we're going to cap off March, Women in History Month, with a chat with the author of a large number of books about women through the ages.
So she's one of the women that I point to as being, you know, a real heroic woman in a different way, you know, in a more private sphere, but her story is important.
First, let's go to the movies. Our guest is well-known to KCBX listeners. Sunday nights, he's the host of Music of the World's People. And for years, he co-hosted Take Two, the movie show. He's Jim D. Welcome, Jim.
Nice to be here, Larry.
In all the years you did the show with Bob Whiteford, you guys never talk much about one side of the movie business, that side of the business of being an exhibitor, running a movie house. Well, it's too bad because you own and operate the Palm Cinema in San Luis Obispo, which I guess is still referred to in the trade as an art house.
Yes.
So I decided to invite you into the studio and own up and tell us about the Palm. I've been here a number of years, but it seemed like it's always been here. What's the background of the Palm, Jim D?
Well, interestingly, the building was the Employment Development Department. It was the place where people went to pick up their unemployment checks. It was built by the state in the 1950s. It had a few different incarnations, and when I took it over in 1988, it was just a shell of a building, and I converted it into the three screens, which was a lot of, working of a building that was not intended to be a theater, digging out the floors, sloping them, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the building was not intended to be a theater, but we turned it into one. We opened in August of 1988, and I guess we're getting into about our 25th year thereabouts. So very grateful to be able to keep the business going and be supported by the community.
Any sort of structural changes in the theater since you opened it?
Structural changes, not really. When we put in our third screen, which is our smallest screen, we did have to pop the roof up because when you get into smaller theaters, the screen size can be kind of small unless you have a nice tall ceiling. And so I structurally did have to pop the roof up quite a bit in our third screen, which is our smallest one. But I think for the size of the room, the screen is a pretty good size.
And how long did it take you to find an audience for the theater?
You know, good question, Larry, because I had another theater in San Luis Obispo from 1979 to 89, which was the Rainbow Theater over on Oso Street. It's now occupied by a Tai Chi studio in the J.P. Andrews building. The Rainbow and the Palm were open for about a year from 88 to 89, but it cost so much money to, redo the Palm building I closed the Rainbow. And at first, when I say at first, I want to say about the first 3 to 4 years, it was quite a struggle. It had some real questionable times up to about, it's funny, I think of 1993, is when we kind of hit our stride. And, of course, opening in 1988, that's a good 4 to 5 years to,
Anytime you can have instant crib death.
Yeah, well, I think of 93 where we had a couple of films, Working Girl and The Crying Game, or for some reason they just hit. And we've been fine ever since, pretty much.
The first few years, was it because of the availability of popular film for your kind of business, or was it just people finding you?
I think it was both. It was mainly people finding us, and it was interesting because a lot of people loved the Rainbow, but the whole ambiance of the Rainbow was like interior brick. It was actually a little bigger than our biggest screen at the Palm. And when we opened up the Palm, sure, it was new, it was kind of sterile maybe, but people just didn't jump at coming to the theater in the first few years. I mean, in fact, we tried to do the art house type of thing at the Palm. We started doing like a second run, you know, bargain house thing for a very short period. That didn't seem to work. So I just kept on doing what I was doing, just tried to bring in decent films to San Luis Obispo. But it really took about 4 to 5 years to the point where I wasn't looking at the books and worrying about how to pay the bills. I mean, it wasn't, it still is a challenge, you know, even these days. But back then, I was really concerned about our survival up to about 93.
Is the biggest problem finding the right releases to show?
That's precisely it. I mean, my motto at the Palm is I want to show movies that people want to see. That sounds very simple and almost elementary, but it's true. I mean, you can bring in certain films that you love or maybe I saw at a film festival, and sometimes they hit and sometimes they don't. Then there are other things that I have that are utterly beyond me, despite being in this business for 30, 35 years. Why some films hit from the get-go and how others don't is beyond me. Like, for instance, Juno, Little Miss Sunshine, Black Swan, day one packed. And I usually ask, well, what was the hook that got you in? Did the preview get you in here? Oh, I had to see Black Swan because it had Natalie Portman. Or I don't know, Juno, I just saw the preview and we had to come in. And there was some sort of mass psychology going on with some of these movies to where they are there from day one. Then there's other films that, you know, take a little time. Maybe the patrons will see it. Word of mouth spreads, and you slowly get a hit. That doesn't happen too often. Or then we have the other option where you show a film and just nobody wants to see it.
What's your biggest surprise on the negative side in recent years?
Biggest surprise on the negative side. That's a good question. Well, just offhand, I thought we showed this documentary on Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He's a great musician, and I was familiar with him, and I thought, hey, there'd be a lot of people coming to see this documentary, and nobody did. Maybe I'm more familiar with him than the public. It's just, I can't think of anything right offhand that where I was very disappointed in, but sometimes I just get a feeling for a certain film, and I think people are going to come see it. Here's a good one that was from last year, A Late Quartet. The film had Christopher Walken. It had Philip Seymour Hoffman. It was about a string quartet. It was a wonderful film, also highlighting Christopher Walken in a very non-eccentric role. I thought he should have easily been nominated in Best Supporting because he is fabulous in it, and he's not playing one of these more stereotypical roles for Christopher Walken. The film got no notice. It got no Academy Award nominations. It was just under the radar, and it was one of my favorite films of last year. So there you go.
One of the big mysteries of the film industry is how something like that happens. That wasn't a cheap movie to make, given the salaries that those actors would require.
Yes.
And they didn't invest any money in it, or the initial reactions were negative?
Well, you know, we had a pretty good turnout at the Palm for it, but not what I expected. And I thought, well, still, the performances in this very fine film will be recognized, and they weren't. You know, one other thing that's kind of interesting about the movie business that drives me a little crazy, I mean, for instance, this weekend, I forget what, but just take any film that opens not so well. They say, oh, after Friday or Saturday, it could be any film, doesn't do up to the expectations. Oh, the film failed at the box office. Well, did the film fail at the box office, or did the promotional campaign fail at the box office? In other words, how can you judge an audience liking a film based on the opening day? Mm-hmm. You can't. I mean, you would tend to think that people will go see it, maybe some word of mouth. Hopefully, if it's a good film, that will increase business. But the business is so funny because when they say, oh, the film failed and it's the opening weekend, well, really, the promotional campaign failed. You know, the film didn't fail. Nobody really saw it up to that point. Funny business.
Funny business. Yeah. The business is the Palm Theater, and our guest is Jim D. How many of the movies that you book are shooting fish in a barrel, and how many have you seen and have some confidence in?
Well, I attend the Toronto Film Festival every year. That's pretty much the only film festival other than the San Luis Obispo Film Festival I attend. But I try to soak up as much as I can there. I'll see, when I attend it, I'll see anywhere from 40 to 50 films over a 10-day period, which is kind of crazy.
Wow.
And among those films, I not only will see things that I definitely want to get at the theater, at the Palm, but there's also a bunch of stuff that I will be asked to play that I don't want to show because, you know, you find out that the movie is kind of a clunker. So that's one way of finding out not only about a number of films that will be coming out this coming year, but ones I don't want. And even the films I don't see at the Toronto Film Festival, you get this catalog that looks like a Sears Roebuck catalog, and it's filled with, you know, 300 films. So you also get a feel for films that might be coming out the coming year just in this one catalog from Toronto.
And how much lead time do you generally have before a film is released where you have to decide whether you want to be an exhibitor of it?
I'll see a certain film at the Toronto Film Festival and notice that it has been picked up by a distributor, and I'll call from Toronto. I'll just call up my booker and just say, hey, you know, I know you're coming out with this film in November, and, you know, I'd definitely like to have it. I remember seeing Sideways at the Toronto Film Festival, and I thought, okay, the perfect film for the Palm, and I immediately called Fox Searchlight. Mm-hmm. And I forgot when it came out around Christmas time, but I lined that one up when I was still in Toronto.
Often we talk these days in film circles, they talk in film circles, about how sort of dreadful the last couple months are, January and February, in terms of releasing movies.
Mm.
I guess that's been the case for a number of years. This year seemed particularly bleak to me.
Really?
Yeah.
The other thought is the fact that there were a number of really good films. If you look at the 9 films in the best picture category for the Oscars, I mean, Argo was in there, Les Mis, a musical, and even something small like Beasts of the Southern Wild is in there. So,
no, I'm not thinking about those. I'm thinking of those released after the frenzy of the Oscar is over.
Oh, okay, sure.
No, this was one of the best years of film I can remember.
Oh, you're talking about afterwards. Yeah.
Yes.
I would say that, you know, Hollywood, you know, puts a lot of their eggs in one basket as far as releasing things around November, December for all those Oscar nominees. And so hopefully you tend to think, and it's kind of what happens, is some of the best movies of the year do come out at the end of the year. But, you know, after you get your Oscar bump and after the Oscars are done, there's kind of a period, I think, like March, April into May. Of course, these days, summer starts like May 1st. I think the new Iron Man's coming out in the 1st of May. So summer usually starts in May now.
That won't be coming to the Palm, I don't imagine.
No. But the blockbusters seem to roll out before summer really kicks in. So we're talking about early May. But, you know, March, April, I would tend to think that there are some releases that they probably didn't have huge, hope for. Also, when you get into like post-summer, it's sort of the similar situation, September, October, mm-hmm. November. You know, if you can get a hit during that time period, you're lucky. But and then sometimes they'll throw in something where they think, you know, nothing else is getting released now and maybe we'll have a, you know, clear field, like the new Oz movie. It seemed to come out after all the Oscars were done and nothing else to go against.
And it actually did fairly well, surprisingly, even though the critics didn't like it all that much.
Yeah, I think it's upwards to 160, 70 million, and it'll hit 200, 250, I'm sure. Worldwide, you know, these days, box office is measured worldwide, and I'm sure Oz will end up making as much as Alice in Wonderland did, which made over $1 billion worldwide.
Well, we're talking with Jim Dee of the Palm Theater, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the Slow Film Festival, because the Palm was quite involved in the film festival, and you, of course, had been involved in it for years. This year's festival, I hear good things.
You know, it was really great, and it was the 19th annual, and I want to say that it's taken San Luis Obispo residents, quite a while for them to get up to speed and really embrace the film festival. I'm not trying to, you know, say anything bad about San Luis, but I've been to other film festivals in other towns where they really embrace it. But film festivals are really hard to not only, you know, make spectacular, but it's such a lot of work. And I would say for a time there, you know, the San Luis Film Festival took a while to get off the ground. And in with regard to the one that we just had in March of 2013, it was some of the best turnouts I've ever seen at the Palm. It seems like people were embracing it. I'd like to hope that people are coming from out of the area to, you know, enjoy the film festival. And what's really, you know, the San Luis Film Festival used to do a lot of classic films, a lot of older films, which were wonderful. And now it seems to have gone over to the other side of all new films. And it's really refreshing, and also seeing very young filmmakers and a lot of short films. It was really spectacular and also concentrated. It's only 5 days now, and I think people were, you know, focused and looking at what was coming in, and all the turnouts at the Palm this year were fabulous.
And the award you gave this year was to an Oscar nominee?
Yeah, John Hawkes. I mean, James Cromwell couldn't make it at the last minute. You know, that's a problem I've seen many, many times in film festivals, where there is a celebrity lined up, and of course he or she gets a job, and they've got to go with the job. And
sure, of course.
So I'm not. I would tend to think there are certain film festivals where they really say you got to, you know, you're going to be here, get an award, and we're going to pay for everything and pay for your presence here. On the other hand, James Cromwell was supposed to be here. He couldn't make it, so Wendy asked me to interview John Hawkes. It was a total pleasure. He was just a great guy. And I tend to think that I called his award the King Vidor Midlife Achievement Award, because this guy has been in the business for like 25, almost 30 years, but he's just hitting his stride now. He's getting more scripts. He told me that, you know, this last few years, I mean, he's finally getting a lot of scripts, a lot of work. He was in Spielberg's Lincoln, even though just a very small role, but still really coming into his own. And what a pleasure to give him the award. And I'm hoping that that King Vidor Award will, you know, spur him on to do more, because I think he's got a lot more to give, John Hawkes.
Let's see, the movie he was in, the name escapes me right now, but that he got the Academy Award for.
Well, he was nominated for Winter's Bone, and we actually brought that back to the Palm. It's an older film. He was more recently in Sessions with Helen Hunt, and she was nominated.
She was fantastic, incidentally.
She was.
She was passed over because I think the competition was particularly good this year, but she was fantastic in that movie.
She was. She was.
Well, we could talk for hours and hours about films we like, dislike, and whatnot, but the movie industry is changing technologically and whatnot. Digital film. I guess everything just about now is being done on digital.
Yeah, it's really, you know, they talked about it for years, and then I want to say the last 2 to 3 years, it came on very strong. And, you know, this is a big deal. To give you an example, these projectors that are digital, if anybody saw Avatar in 3D or 3D, you know, you saw it digitally projected. There's no film. The film comes like on a hard drive, and it's loaded into the projector. Where we're at right now, according to my digital installer, I think America has something like 35, 36,000 screens. We're talking about 31, 32,000 have converted. So all of this 35 millimeter equipment that's been running film for the last 100 plus years is all kind of going into the scrap heap, and it's an entirely new technology. The industry has really taken the quantum leap, and unfortunately, I know there's a lot of theaters across the country that just said, gee, I'm not going to spend $70,000 on this digital projector. I'm going to either go out of business or I just can't afford it. So,
you have digital?
Two of my three screens right now are digital. My third screen will go digital in the middle of May of 2013, and it's the way it has to be. You know, again, I each week now, while I still have my third screen 35 millimeter, I just have to hope that I can get some sort of a 35 millimeter print, because they are getting few and far between.
So that's one of the challenges of your industry. Another challenge, of course, is video on demand that goes into the home. Is there an industry-wide strategy of countering that for people who are in the exhibit business?
Other than being upset about it, no. It's one of those things where the movie industry, you know, let's just say they make a big movie and they're spending all this money on their promotional campaign. Well, they do want it in the movie theaters first, but then shortly thereafter, or sometimes simultaneously, they'll have video on demand. So you can see the movie at a movie theater, but you can also see it in your hotel room or if you have a certain cable hookup. So now the distributors or the studios are getting more bang for their promotional dollar because more people can see it. And I can't help but get the feeling that the theaters are sometimes left out in the cold, because I think the theater is the best place to see or to first see a movie. It's the best presentation. It's probably the way the filmmakers intended you to see that movie. But now, you know, there are so many other options, video on demand or, you know, in some cases, rare cases, they'll release the DVDs the same day as in the movie theater. They haven't done that too much, but in some rare cases they have.
Yes, they have.
So, I mean, incidentally, you can make $400 million with a movie like Shrek with a theatrical run. Then you release the DVD, you make $400 million in the first week, I mean, on the DVD. So you can understand maybe how the movie industry is video-driven. They want to get that video of Shrek into the Costco, and they can sell a gazillion copies and make a whole lot more money with that video sale than the theater.
All right, Jim D., over the next 6 months or so, movies to look for in the Palm Theater that have got you excited?
Well, let's see. The new Danny Boyle film is coming out, and he's a pretty provocative director. He did Slumdog Millionaire and 127 Hours. His new one is called Trance. It has James McAvoy in it. It looks pretty tough going, but he's a pretty, I don't want to say flamboyant, but he's an interesting filmmaker. We're opening up On the Road this week at the Palm. That's the film adaptation of the famous Jack Kerouac novel or book. I'm just trying to think what else we have. Some interesting foreign language films that are kind of under the radar that I enjoy bringing in. Again, if we have a very small audience, I'm still...
If they're 35 millimeter and you can show them in the small theater.
Yeah. There's a film coming in called Room 237, which is supposedly an examination of Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining, where there's all these so-called hidden meanings. I don't particularly buy it. I'm kind of a Kubrick fan, but I didn't think of him as a guy who puts hidden meanings in his film. But this is a very intriguing documentary of these Stanley Kubrick aficionados who said he injected all these secret meanings into The Shining. So that's called Room 237. It's based on a room that is featured in The Shining, and that's at the end of April. There's also a film called Starbuck. It's played at a lot of film festivals. It's from France. I've gotten a lot of feedback on this because a number of people have seen it at film festivals. And, well, the premise of this is this guy was a former sperm donor. And it was used a lot. So he's got a lot of kids out there. And that's the premise of the movie. And what this guy does is try to go see all of his children that are essentially his. And it's supposed to be a very, very funny comedy. We have that at the end of April. So those are coming up.
Jim D. of the Palm Theater, it's been fascinating. I could talk movies for hours, and I'm sure you could too. Our time has run out. Thank you for stopping by.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. In a few minutes, we're going to celebrate Women in History Month with author Vicki Leon and some of the men in support of some famous women.
Mark Anthony, he really would deserve the word stud.
But now we're going to look forward to April, National Poetry Month, hosted by director of the SLO Public Library, Brian Reynolds.
We're joined by some library staff, Joe Lorenzi, who is the branch manager at Los Osos, and also by several local poets, Kevin Clark, Lisa Kaufman, and Leslie St. John. Joe, could we get started talking about poetry and how important it is?
Sure, Brian. Just want to say thank you to our guests for coming today. It's great to have you. I've met all of you before, and hoping this will be a great show. So, you know, I love poetry, and I just want to know why you guys love poetry as well. Why is poetry important in San Luis Obispo County? Lisa.
Boy, I think poetry keeps me alive. I mean, it's been part of my earliest connection even to speech. That's, my mother read poems to me when I was little, and I thought that was what language was there for.
Leslie St. John, Cal Poly professor here in San Luis Obispo, why do you love poetry?
I like Lisa's answer because it keeps me alive. I think that poetry allows for this dramatic unfolding, and I think I experienced that when I was really young as well, from writing poems and putting them on my father's door to writing poetry after I had an accident when I was a teenager to writing poetry in my adult life. I fortunately had the opportunity to teach poetry at Poly this quarter, and I loved seeing my engineers and architects writing about their shadow selves and exploring the relationship between the body and yoga and poetry. And so I saw this unfolding in my students, and that was really exciting. So I think it's personally important for us.
Kevin, how about you?
I think we're 3 for 3 in terms of how important poetry has been to all of us from such an early age. When I was a little boy, poetry was important to me, and I was writing it in grammar school and in high school, and you know, my father died young, and boy, poetry was really important to me then. I was reading and writing it. I remember getting my first book of poems. It was a Robert Frost book, the Louis Untermeyer version of the Robert Frost selected. And then my second book was Dylan Thomas's. And it was just all so rich and important. And it said to me, there is this mystery inside yourself, and there is a voice for that mystery, and it's something called poetry. And there you have it.
Do you all think that poetry has changed over the years, both in substance or its influence on society? Any highlights you can think of, say, in the past 20 years? Lisa?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways it doesn't change at all. It's such an ancient art. It predates, you know, the technology of the written word. And there's still a deep part of us that just likes to come together for those small, live readings and experience what, you know, the poet has come out of thought and solitude to tell us. And when those go well, they're one of the most intimate, present, beautiful experiences you can have. So that part, in a way, hasn't changed. I think one thing that we have seen, you've seen an increase in degrees that you can get in creative writing, sort of an institutional stamp that says you're a poet. You've seen a rise in spoken word and slam poetry, more performance poetry. And I think you've seen a real proliferation with the internet, with access, that some of the gates are down and it's easier to get your work out there and put it online and get a readership and combine it with other technologies.
I think that I go along with everything Lisa says. The poetry reading itself, since the 1960s, has proliferated. And in this county, it has really proliferated. It's been astonishing how a county with under 300,000 people can have so many poetry readings all the time and very well attended. You know, I don't want to be blasphemous in any way, but it's almost a sacred event when it works well.
Content-wise, it's changed so much, too. My introduction to poetry was Gerard Manley Hopkins. So I started with every line loaded with ore and intensity, and he explored kind of spirituality and religion and his relationship with God and his self. And then yesterday I read a poem, Kinky, by Denise Duhamel, which is about Ken and Barbie, you know, having this intimate encounter where they switch body parts, basically. So the content is, you know, the doors are blasted wide open in terms of what we can do with content, and that's exciting. Also, I think collaboration. I did a poetry and architecture project. I'm exploring yoga and poetry. And so I see more and more collaboration happening now, which is exciting as well.
You know, it was mentioned earlier that poetry preceded the written word, and it made me think that a lot of times poetry was sung, sometimes with an instrument like a harp or a drum, and it conveyed the news. It talked about love affairs or scandals. And in those days, it had rhythm and rhyme more, I think, because it needed to be memorable, especially epic poems that were long. But maybe nowadays, where poetry is available either live or written down, I was just thinking the rhythm or the rhyme aren't as important because it's accessible and you don't have to memorize it as much, because things that are rhymed are easily memorized, but maybe you don't need to memorize it, just feel it. How about the concept? I've always thought of poetry as a synthesis, a distillation of thought, where you take extraneous words or feelings and, like a sculptor would sculpt something, getting rid of bits of extraneous bits of stone or wood, mm-hmm. you get down to the essence of it, and so that what you're left with is almost a supercharged 150 proof experience. Have you thought about that at all?
I think there's a way that poetry gets at the – there's a branch of poetry that gets at sort of – it's the essential oil of the experience, and it really distills it, and it's very condensed. And I think of, for instance, poems by Basho that I love that just say it all in three lines.
Hard to do.
You have to be a master. But I think there's the other branch of poetry that is sprawling and takes its time. I think of Whitman's yes. Song of Myself, and he mm-hmm. his lines go on from the East Coast to the West. They just fill the continent.
Somebody said Lewis Carroll did with Jabberwocky what J.R.R. Tolkien did with three large books.
Wow.
Maybe we can we're sitting here with Kevin Clark, Cal Poly professor, author of Self-Portrait with Expletives. Also Lisa Kaufman, Cal Poly professor. Her new book is Less Obvious Gods, should be out pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And Leslie St. John, Beauty Like a Rope, her book. She's also a Cal Poly professor. And she's also doing a program at Smiling Dog Yoga.
And the context, Joe, for our program today on Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast is National Poetry and Poetry Month. It seems like what we would want to do is hear from some of our poets and some of their own works, something they're proud of.
Well, I brought in a poem that's coming out that'll be in my upcoming book, Less Obvious Gods, and I wrote it to my daughter before I met her, really. I was pregnant with her, and the poem is Born Under the Sign of. You came in under the vacancy light of my hotel sign heart, under the spearhead of my brash and undivided hips. Now when I wheel down with the other constellations to rest, you give me such a poke and shove, school bully stuff, you can't have meant it. Nor the way you crank up my ribs, a thief getting in a window. Math cannot account for us, neither one nor two, nor any of the numbers for in between. One of us standing, the other lying down. One making fists, the other typing full sentences. And sometimes we face opposite ways, like opponents in a duel. When they marqueed you on the sonogram screen, when they said, as in an indictment, there's the brain, heart's all right, spine, lips, feet, kidneys, I saw you were already packing to leave. Neat valise of your head and chest filled with the rolled and folded things you'd need. Still, the hand I lay on you is laid on me. The kindest hand I've had for myself. Rocking soothes us, a motion made of go and come back.
So awesome. Whenever I hear you guys read, it's like being with like in an in a stadium, listening to Mick Jagger or, you know, the Rolling Stones rock
out.
I mean, that's how intense if you really get into poetry. And I always tell Lisa I enjoy listening to her. What a rock star.
Many thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to be a grandfather for the first time next month, so I don't think our audience could hear me crying, but I was. Leslie, how about you?
Well, I wasn't planning on reading this one, but Lisa just read a poem to her daughter, so I thought I would read this poem, which is to my mother. She washed my hair. After the corn snake lines to Cornerstone, a Christian music festival in Bushnell, Illinois, after the ska show under the big tent, after skankin' and cheers and beach balls bouncing over our heads, the CD case struck my eye, expelling green iris and lens to the dirt. After the body-pushing, rope-tripping, car maze walk to the first-aid trailer, after the cold vinyl, potholed van ride to the hospital, after the 2 a.m. operation on the 4th of July, the 42 stitches, After my newly divorced father and mother drove across four states, a pillow barrier between them, to bring me home to Arkansas. The new room my aunts assembled from what was still in boxes in the garage. Monet's lily pads on the wall, music box on the chest of drawers, winter clothes in the closet, a gold-leafed gift book on the nightstand. He will wipe every tear from your eye. He will make the blind to see again. After the month of casseroles and cards, after my father's only visit, 24 stargazer lilies, after Dr. Medcleff injected an expandable bubble of gas in my eye to seal the retina, raise the pressure, after days of lying on my left side to eat saltine crackers, drink Sprite, stare out the window and watch summer slip away like an apology, all the while trying not to cough or sneeze or hiccup or burst my chance, after walking to the restroom, head bent like a thin poplar in wind, trying hard not to disturb the tightrope act in my eye, that I might see, that I might keep the eye face intact. After Mom raised my lid to drop medicine, she washed my hair, untangling rusted screw curls, not with force as she had after dance recitals and ice skating competitions, but with care, a jeweler unknotting a thin gold chain, rubbing each kink smooth. Her small hand supported my head, dangling from the foot of the bed, the other tipping an iced tea pitcher of water to rinse the shampoo. So how to tell her now? 12 years, 2 states, 1 husband, and 3 prosthetic eyes later, she made me feel even this loss as love.
That was Leslie St. John from her book, Beauty Like a Rope.
While you were writing about motherhood and you were writing about your relationship to your mother, I'm going to read about my father. This is a poem called Radio Fate. I grew up in New Jersey, and my father would listen to the comic Gene Shepherd, who would just talk. He would talk into the night on radio, and he'd broadcast out of the village in New York. And then my father secretly told me, and my mother wasn't altogether happy about this, but my father told me I could listen if I had a little transistor radio and put it under my pillow. I could listen as well. Radio Fate. I'm 12, and the Lafayette transistor in its leather case is buried beneath my pillow, beneath my ear. My brother asleep in the next bed, my mother down the hall brushing her teeth, my beat father cackling to himself as the monologue finds the radios of the male Northeast. And while Gene Shepherd tells his story about sad-assed peacetime Company K, or how he led the improbable Wanda Hickey to his only prom, or how summer evenings his own bushed father came home, sucked down a Windy City beer, and moaned at the rasping radio fate of the White Sox, my father, who'd be dead in 2 years, heaves an occasional breathless laugh, and I begin to figure how funny has to work. From 10:15 to 11, monologist Gene Shepherd broadcasts from the limelight in the village, a brooding, otherworldly neon bar in my Jersey picturing. Stories of the poor, luckless slobs in the masochistic grip of what's to come showed each a searing flash of success, led one regular guy after another to the urgent verge of garlands and a rejuvenate wife. But then, in Shepherd's voice-cracking empathies, they had to witness it all dissolve in their calloused hands, as down deep they knew it would. Shepherd's denouement led all of us to exhale into the static. And as I heard my father breathing tight above me to make sure I'd turned off the radio, I'd heard enough to know the future had to end in tough luck, that if jokes held truth, I'd best be the butt of every wise-ass line to come, that there was one darkness only and 2 ways to enter it.
I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director, for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we're celebrating National Poetry Month, poetry and poets. And we just heard readings by Kevin Clark and Leslie St. John and Lisa Kaufman, very moving poetry.
I love to go to poetry events on the Central Coast. Why is it important to experience that one-on-one or audience to poet relationship that develops? Kevin, why is that important?
I think I went to my first poetry reading at 18 or 19 years old. But before that, I had Robert Frost on a big old album. And I used to listen to so many of the Frost poems, especially after apple picking, and just swoon. There's something about the voice of the poet that is carrying his or her intention to you with all the intended inflections that's so lovely. But I also want to say that there's nothing like being at a reading. All of us giving our best attention to the best words that this person has to offer. And I just want to say, since it's National Poetry Month, in April, I believe it's April 19th at Cal Poly, we're going to be bringing a terrific, funny, but serious poet named Charles Harper Webb from Los Angeles. He's going to rock the Casbah, man. He's really going to be great. So April 19th, Cal Poly, I'm pretty sure it'll be free. So.
Leslie, you have the yoga and writing workshop at the Smiling Dog Yoga Center. What's that going to be like if people join you?
Well, it's called Prose and Poses, and it's a five-week class. It meets for 2 hours on Monday nights, 6:30 to 8:30. And the first hour of class is yoga asana. The second hour is reading and writing. And the idea is that you put your body and your mind in a kind of more relaxed and open and receptive place so that you can make these free associations.
And Lisa, tell us about your book that's coming out. What can we expect from it, and what did you put into it?
It's titled Less Obvious Gods. Indicates there are a series of odes that are throughout the book that are written to some gods that I found. They're not very overt. They don't have temples. They don't collect tithes, but they exert quite an influence on my life, like the base or time or pain or cold. So they're odes kind of in the manner of Neruda, inspired by that, but my voice with them. That's what to look for.
I do want to mention that if you go on to slowlibrary.org, you'll see some poetry events also happening at San Luis Obispo County Libraries. Again, we have Kevin Clark, who author of Self-Portrait with Expletives, and Lisa Kaufman, author of Less Obvious Gods, and Leslie St. John, author of Beauty Like a Rope.
So we're so grateful that our poets are here today. We encourage people to read and write and enjoy poetry. Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas. Thank you.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, and I'm your host, Larry Rutter. Support for KCBX comes from the Natural Foods Co-op of San Luis Obispo, serving San Luis Obispo County for the last 32 years, offering special ordering programs and a helpful and knowledgeable staff. Complete information at 544-7928. And now let's consider some women in history. Our guest bio says she's the author of 35 titles, about half of them for readers 10 and up. But she's written widely about what she calls outrageous women in history. So we thought it might be a good idea to finish out Women's History Month here at KCBX with a chat with Morrow Bay's own Vicki Leone. Welcome to the microphone.
Thank you so much, Larry.
You've written so much about women in history. Women in written history have had fairly minor roles. We can almost name on the fingers of one hand the historically significant women in written history. Why do you think that is?
Oh, that's an easy thing. You see, most writings from ancient times and clear up until very modern times, by and large, have been by men, and they've been written for men. They've been aimed at men, not just men as an audience, but one's patron. I mean, so much of what was written in the past, they were subsidized by a patron. I mean, that was really how writers, made a living, or how they were subsidized. And so consequently, there's a heavy emphasis on guy stuff, wars and bang, bang, boom, boom, and scandals and politics and so on. And so consequently, I think that women really got short shrift in that department. And on occasion, reason they were mentioned, like you say, if they were terribly important, if they were a Joan of Arc or if they were a Queen Elizabeth, naturally they got a lot of ink.
But they were the patrons in those cases.
So, in those cases,
at least
they
Queen Elizabeth was a patron.
Yeah. Women, when they have gained power, whether it was done in some legitimate, you know, form like a monarchy, or less legitimate form, which is to say that, you know, by their own political strength or wits, you know, they've been vilified quite a bit. So in some ways, people like Cleopatra were very convenient scapegoats.
Hmm. Hey, women, do you think, get a bad press in history, that they're looked to be conniving? There must be some nefarious reason why they have power, why they have influence on events?
I think sometimes, yes. And this is just all part and parcel of the same thing. It's because it was not common for women to be able to hold the reins of power, in particular, you know, ruling power, then I would say that, yes, it was easier just to say, oh, well, she must be conniving. It must be some kind of woman's wiles that has gotten her there, not brains, mm-hmm. even though they could clearly see that a given woman, whether it's Catherine the Great or whoever it was, you know, had brains.
They often refer to journalism as the first draft of history. So do you think this first draft of history today still overlooks women?
To a certain extent, but it certainly is much better than it was. You know, today is, it's wonderful today as compared to, you know, even 100 years ago or 200 years ago. So I would say, you know, I'm thrilled to be alive today because my books would never have been printed. But there were a great many women who did things, you know, marvelous things, and they were, completely ignored or almost completely ignored. They're not.
Give me an example.
When I used to live in Spain, which was years ago when I was first married and learning how to cook. And so I decided that I wanted to learn to make something Spanish, and I thought, I'll learn how to make flan. It's made with a double boiler, and I didn't have one, so I set out to find one of my. By now, my Spanish was pretty good. I'd been there a year or two. And so, you know, I'm asking and asking, and no one has any idea what I'm talking about. Finally, I found one. And the reason I couldn't find one was that initially it had the strangest name. It was called the Mary's Bath, the Baño María. And I thought, well, that's a funny thing. What's that all about now? And some years later, when I did start writing, I was reading something from the Loeb Classical Library. It mentioned female alchemist and a female alchemist who lived in the first century A.D. And this woman was named Mary. She was an alchemist, and she had several last names. She had lived in this city, which was known for metallurgy and for jewelry making and artisans. But Mary, so she was an early chemist, as the rest of the alchemists were. Mary had invented the double boiler, carried through 20 centuries, at least, through the memory of cooks.
Vicky Leone is our guest. She lives in Morro Bay, but she's a writer, has written volumes about women in history. And we're celebrating Women in History Month by chatting with her. In what historical period beside the current, the modern period, do you think women had the most influence on events?
I would tend to say that possibly in Renaissance times, because there were a great many women who actually were able to become philosophers. They were able to become writers and get fairly well known. There was a wonderful woman named Rosa Buford, an English woman, and again, very little known in this case, but she obtained the monopoly to trade in wool in England. And so there were women a lot of acumen and very astute women, well-read knew their numbers and so on and so forth, such as Rose in that period. But one of the periods that I like best, of course, and so I have more women probably from it just because I've spent many years studying it, of course, is just sort of the nearly 800 to 1,000 years that where you've got, you know, sort of from classical Greece up through the end of the Roman Empire. So that period, there are plenty of women that I have found who did, you know, remarkable things. And some of them weren't necessarily work things. For example, we were just talking about Cleopatra. Well, you know, Mark Anthony was you could call him he really would deserve the word stud. Realize where he even found time to go fighting, you know, because he really, really did, you know, propagate. And at any rate, one of them, of course, was Cleopatra. But before that, he had been married to a number of other women. But the most important one was a gal named Octavia, who was the sister of Octavian Augustus, first emperor of Rome. And she had become widowed. And you know, Mark Anthony and Octavian sort of horse-traded around about, well, if you do this for me, then I'll do this for you. And so consequently, Mark Anthony married Octavia. Well, as you know, then after a while, Mark Anthony fell so hard for Cleopatra that he began sort of commuting. He sort of commuted between wives, and it must have been really quite hard to do because, you know, Egypt's over here and Italy's over there, and then you might make a side trip to Greece and so on and so forth, and I'll fight a little war over here. So he's a busy guy. But eventually, of course, he ended up, you know, dead of suicide. Octavia, the remarkable part about her was that she had been married to three different men, and but she took on the role of mother to not only the children that she had with Mark Antony, but the children that he had with Cleopatra, and the children that she'd had with blah blah before and his prior wives. And she was a wonderful mother to all of them without the kind of rancor you would think would, you know, happen when, you know, it was done from those kind of no good husband in a way. So she's one of the women that I point to as being, you know, a real heroic woman in a different way, you know, in a more private sphere, but her story is important. Now, I wrote about her in, I have a book called 4,000 Years of Uppity Women, and that's sort of a best-of compendium, and that one came out a couple of years ago. And
who else from that compendium comes to mind? Is maybe somebody we've never heard of, like Octavia, that had an enormous influence.
Well, one of the ones that really fascinates me is called Hypsocratea. Have you heard of her?
No.
Well, you've heard of the Amazons. The
Amazon women. Yes, right.
And most people still think that was mythology, correct?
Yes.
Well, archaeologists have proven that there were quite a number of tribes in that part of the world where Scythia was, and sort of Asia Minor and up around the Caspian and Black Seas. They have proven that indeed there were women warriors in various of those societies, various of those nomadic societies. And Hypsocratea was one of them. Now, she became famous in her day because she was the sort of last lover of, and not only lover, but she was the sort of enforcer and bodyguard of Mithridates. Do you know the king Mithridates of Pontus? He is the one that... he fought off the Romans for decades. He was the one who, who riled up all the pirates and sent them against Rome. And that's when Pompey the Great came and, you know, sort of kicked butt and all that business. But he was an interesting person, a very, very, very much a real renegade sort of ruler who wanted to rule that part of the world, which if you looking at Italy and then Greece and then what we call Turkey now, that part of Asia Minor and then going clear to the Caucasus Mountains, that's where his domain was and around the Black Sea part of it. But Hypsocratea became his not only lover, but one of his fighters late in his life. He was about 60, 65 at the time. And she was a younger woman. She was probably late 30s, maybe early 40s. And for 6 years, she pretty much, you know, kept his back. I mean, she went with him and fought with him. They were being chased by the Romans all through the mountains, and there were battles, and there were all these different sorts of things. And in the end, Mithridates died or was you know betrayed and killed by one of his many children. But Hypsocratea disappeared from history. And we later find out that at the same time she disappears, a man called Hypsocrates pops up, who is a historian and an explorer and a person of great intelligence and who sort of used as an expert on that very same area. And in fact, in terms of looking at the ancient world, she was a really important person and a key person.
We're talking with Vicky Leon. She is an author of 35 at least books, and she is an expert, I think, on women's history. And she also is a neighbor. She lives in Morro Bay, and we're talking about women in history. All right, Vicky Leon, who is the most overrated woman in history? Somebody that whose name we would know, but do you think we overrate their influence? We've been talking about people we didn't know who have had great influence, and I don't want to pick a name, but there are famous, obviously, women in history that we all know about. But maybe one of them, in your view, is overrated.
If we could substitute the word excessively written about and maybe not correctly, then we could say someone like Cleopatra was, because the writings and so on about her have been excessive. I mean, really a lot of writing about her, and a great deal of it very misleading and not correct, and not even very good research done. So that probably doesn't really answer your question, but I guess I have such a thing about uppity women and outrageous women that the idea of one of them being overrated is just, you know, it's just not resonating with me here.
Forgive me. You've written a lot of books, and most of them deal with a sweep of history.
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, you haven't written a single one-person biography of a woman.
Actually, I have.
Have you?
Yeah, and this one is someone who was certainly has been maligned just as Cleopatra was. This woman, in fact, you'd have to say girl rather than woman, her name was Malinalli, and that's a Mayan name. Mm. And she was a young woman, lived in a village which was over in the coast of Mexico. This was in the 1500s, early 1500s AD. And her father was a chief of a small village. And suddenly this miraculous, frightening thing happened. These giant canoes sailed into the bay, and these strange creatures, all hairy, came out with these strange animals and these fire sticks and so on. And what it was Cortez. Cortez and the Spaniards had arrived. And anyway, to make a long story short, because the story goes on, very soon Captain Cortez learned that this girl was not only very sharp, very bright, but she was multilingual. And Malinalli became his key. That was his absolute secret weapon to the conquest of Mexico. And I don't think that story is very well known. The other thing that she did was that she introduced him as they went along. She knew which tribes were hostile, very hostile to the Aztecs, and which ones weren't. So with Malinalli's help, he enlisted these other tribes to help him fight the Aztecs.
What's your next project?
Well, I'm toying with the idea of writing a book about ancient medicine and healing.
Oh.
I just finished this one about the joy of sexes, which is, again, all about biology, and it's about, you know, love stories as well as about, you know, what kind of sexual practices the Greeks and Romans had and what kind of superstitions the Egyptians had and so on. But I found all kinds of wonderful medicine things along the way, and so I've already got files started on them.
Well, Vicky Leon is the author. Her latest book is called The Joy of Sexes, Lust, Love, and Longing in the Ancient World. We've had a time to chat with her about women in history and whet our appetite to learn more. We've enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas. We'd like to thank our guests, Jim D. of the Palm Theater, Brian Reynolds and Joe Lorenzi of the Slow Library, and poets Kevin Clark, Lisa Kaufman, and Leslie St. John, and author Vicki Leon. For Issues and Ideas and KCBX, listener-supported radio for the Central Coast, this is Larry Rutter.